Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast where good taste and bad taste seek a new architect for the Security Bank of Gotham. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. That was a Batman thing, wasn't it?
It's a Justice League thing.
Specifically, well, you said Gotham. That's Batman City.
Yeah, but it's a reference from... we'll talk about Justice League when we get to Justice League.
Oh, must we? I suppose
well,
we have to.
Yeah, we kind of have to, yeah. My name's Whitney Bibbiani. Everybody calls me Bibbs. He's Whitney Seibold. Mm-hmm. Everybody doesn't call him Bibbs.
No one calls me Bibbs, in fact.
Not yet. And this week on Critically Acclaimed, we're reviewing the new releases Quo Vadis, Aida, Slacks, and Rose Plays Julie. We're also reviewing the old movie... Justice League, except now it's got a spiffy new director's cut, courtesy of Zack Snyder, and this is not one of those director's cuts where it's a little different. Mm. To be fair, there's a lot of stuff in it, so we're going to treat it as its own thing, and not just be like, "Ah, they added a scene to Gladiator."
No, they literally doubled the length, so yeah. There's a lot to talk about.
It's
well,
a very different film.
Not too much to talk about, but we'll talk about the new Justice League.
I think it warrants some serious consideration, and because, once again, during the pandemic, while we're watching everything on streaming, we want to make sure that we're not ignoring older movies on streaming just as we watch all the new releases and get excited about them. So every week, Whitney and I are watching at least one movie, older movie, that either one or both of us have never seen before, as chosen by our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Whew, almost lost it there. and this week, the poll winner, we had a bunch of movies from Paramount Plus, and the poll winner was Infernal Affairs, a.k.a. the film that inspired Martin Scorsese's The Departed. That was a remake of a Hong Kong action movie. Well, Hong Kong action-y, dramedy, crimey.
It's a crime film.
It's a crime film. Mm. It's got some action, but it's got Andy Lau and it's got Tony Leung, and it's a cool film. And I was surprised Whitney hadn't seen it, so we're gonna talk about that later on in the episode.
My first time I got to see Infernal Affairs.
But before we get to any of that, we have to start with some bad news. We lost yet another titan in the industry. We lost actor Yaphet Kotto. Who you might recall from such films as Alien, Live and Let Die, and Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare.
That's right. He was in a Freddy movie.
he was bringing in class and respectability to the sixth very classless Freddy Nightmare on Elm Street movie.
That's a terrible movie, by the way.
It's not a good film.
Freddy's Dead, it's I'll watch it. It's fun.
It's fun,
but it's pretty terrible.
It turns it into like a Looney Tune. Like it's really just the tone is way off. And that's kind of like the nail in the coffin of that franchise for a while was after Freddy's Dead, not only was Freddy dead, which had happened before, but he just wasn't scary anymore. There was just nothing scary about it. And that led us to Wes Craven's New Nightmare. And that led us to Freddy vs. Jason. And that led us to nothing happened after that. We didn't have another one.
My suggestion is for the next Friday, the 13th or next... Mixed them up. The next
Freddy
Nightmare,
the 13th.
Next Nightmare on Elm Street is just hire Maria Bello to play Frieda Krueger.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, just gender flip it.
But back to Yaphet Kotto. Yaphet Kotto was a great actor.
He was.
Whitney, you've actually seen more of his films than I have.
I suppose so.
We talked about it a little bit before the podcast.
I do. I really admire Yaphet Kotto. He's very friendly. Like brought a kind of stern humanism to most of his roles. I guess Alien might be his most popular movie, the one that most people have seen, perhaps, where he was just sort of this working stiff. He was the one who was always talking about when do we get paid.
Yeah, but we need to talk about this bonus situation.
Yeah, he didn't have a lot of just sort of dialogue or big scenes to himself, but he put so much into the little scenes he had that we got a great, not just a sense of who his character was, but... a lot about what this universe is like.
Yeah.
That
these are just
blue collar stiffs in a science fiction setting. So, and he brought that even into a lot of his main roles. The first, earliest film of his that I saw was Across 110th Street, which was sort of like this film noir where he plays this by the books cop who ends up like doing favors for like some criminal friends of his. It's really, really good. And not just because the song is awesome. I've heard the song 1,000 times because they played it over the credits of Jackie Brown. But yeah, he was really, really good in Across 110th Street. I have not seen the film he made with Larry Cohen, Bone.
I heard that one's great.
He played the title character. And yeah, I've heard nothing but great things about Bone, and it is I am remiss in not having seen Bone. But yeah, he was in a lot of blaxploitation films throughout the 1970s. He was in Friday Foster. That was another one I saw him in. That was a Pam Grier film. That was a Scatman Crothers and a bunch of other people.
Live and Let Die was basically James Bond's version of a blaxploitation film.
Yeah.
It was Bond often tries to sort of capitalize on what's popular contemporaneously, which is, you know, Casino Royale was like, hey, we're in the post-Bourne era and everyone likes parkour. Let's put those things in a movie, like that kind of deal. But it also goes with, oh, Star Wars is big, we'll do Moonraker. And, Live and Let Die was James Bond being pulled into an adventure involving Caribbean drug smuggling. And over the course of the film, like, practically every person of color in that movie is in on it, in this weird kind of cartoonish conspiracy. And Yaphet Kotto plays the main bad guy. He plays Dr. Kananga, who has the most amazing death scene in all of James Bond history.
Well, speaking of Looney Tunes, he gets inflated to death. And you can find pictures online of the inflatable version of Yaphet Kotto they had to build to achieve special effect. It's the dumbest looking thing. But yeah, he gets inflated to death in that movie. Notwithstanding, he was a very dignified actor. I'm not familiar with his work on Homicide, but he was on Homicide for a long time.
Watch that show either, but a lot of people were talking
He played Othello in a production of Othello that was never released. So I was I'm hoping that they sort of scour this up, because I would love to see him play Othello.
And it was going to be like his original, like his like debut. Like it started off and like was filmed in like the 60s, and it just never got released. It finally screened like once in 1980, but like that's it. Yeah, like it's crazy.
Where's like Arrow Video or something that needs to sort of scrape that one up?
Someone like track that thing down. What are you doing? But Mubi exclusive. Let's make it happen.
Yeah, there you go. But yeah, he was one of those actors who worked across like genres and budgets and types of films. In that he was in a lot of like serious crime dramas, but he would also be in big budget Hollywood genre films, like Alien. Yeah. He was also in The Running Man.
Yeah, which is The Puppet Masters.
That's the '90s, The Puppet Masters, not the Andre Toulon full moon.
No,
movies.
But like that was still like a major like studio schlocky horror thing.
He played the Fed in Midnight Run. Mm-hmm. It was, and as you said, he was in Freddy's Dead: The Final Nightmare. I think he was doing a lot more TV near the end of his career, like his film credits sort of drop off after a while. And plus he was getting up there. He died in his early 80s. But golly, always a delight to see Yaphet Kotto show up in a movie. He always had such just strength and charisma and this is kind of a meaningless word, but so much attitude that he was able to make all of his characters really just sort of breathe and live. It was just so, so great.
Well, Yaphet Kotto, you will be missed. Thank you so much for everything you've done for the world of cinema and for audiences everywhere. Mm-hmm. And should we start? This is always a jarring transition. Every single time we have to transition from eulogizing somebody to reviewing a new movie. But should we end? Obviously, we're going to end with Infernal Affairs. Should we end with Justice League, or should we talk about Justice League right now?
Oh, I'd rather talk about Slacks, if we may.
That's the one you want to start with?
I want to start with Slacks.
You want to start with Slacks?
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Killer Blue Jeans movie.
It's about killer pants. Slacks is a Canadian...
You can wait for Justice League.
Yeah, no, because you're going to hear about the pants movie, all right? You've seen Justice League. You don't need to hear us talk about Justice League. We've seen it twice now.
That's not what film criticism is about. It's not like you've seen it, you don't need to hear any conversation about it. It's about the conversation.
I understand
that's
that.
The point. Okay.
But the more important conversation is the movie about the killer pants.
Okay.
Slacks, S-L-A-X-X, is... it's a movie about a killer pair of pants. What can I say?
It's exactly the movie it's going to be.
It opens in almost exactly the same way as the remake of Child's Play, where we get to see the origin of the thing being built and how it became. We learn a little bit more about how it became evil later on, but...
A pair of pants is made.
It makes its way to this really super hip. It's a lot like American Apparel type hipster clothing store where everything's overpriced. And the story follows a young girl who's getting a job there for the first time, and she learns very quickly that everybody there is a horrible dick.
Yeah.
Because that's the way you write when you can't write. You just make everybody cruel.
Oh, I don't think that's the case. Mm. I weirdly enough, I sympathized with that, because this is a movie that takes place almost entirely at a clothing store, at a corporate clothing store, overnight. While they're doing a new, there's a new line of pants that's being released. It's a big new clothing push. They have to restock everything, put up all the, redress all the mannequins, put up all the posters.
And they have a celebrity Instagram influencer coming to hype the jeans. That's a big deal.
So this is like a big, big night. However, it is also corporate retail. And if you've ever worked corporate retail, it sucks.
It's the worst thing.
It's miserable. And you're combined. There's like two kinds of people who work at corporate retail. People who don't want to be there because this is the job they could get right now. They're working their way through college or something. And worse, the people who want to be there.
The people who see this as like some important career stepping stone.
And that's not, and I'm not disrespecting a career in retail. That's not, I don't mean to disrespect that, but there's a particular, if you've worked in corporate retail, and I've worked for a few different like big chains in my life, there's a particular vibe you get sometimes when someone in middle management is way too intense about this shit. Like they think that they're like responsible for like, you know, the leading the charge at the Battle of Verdun. And it's like, no, I have to rewind these VHSs and put them back in alphabetical order. You can calm the hell down right now.
I worked for Blockbuster, too.
I worked in Hollywood Video. It's a little different, but not much.
No, it's not really.
Not much different. It's different because of the spelling. But in any case, I've worked with shitty middle management. And this is a movie that's very much about shitty middle management. There's a shitty middle management guy. He's treating everyone like he's following everything by the book. He believes everything corporate tells him is right. And we are going to, by God, we're going to have this thing done in record time. I'm going to show everybody that I deserve to be in upper middle management. And, a pair of pants seems to be mysteriously murdering various underlings of mine. I can hide that and get the job done. And we'll deal with the cops tomorrow. Because we're on lockdown right now. No one's supposed to be using their cell phones. Fuck you, Chad. Yeah,
no one's going in or out, and nobody's allowed to use their cell phones. And they're locked in all night, I guess.
Yeah.
Which sounds like... It sounds like at some point people would just get a little loopy. And people would be acting like kind of weird and joking around a lot.
There's I've done inventory.
Yeah.
That's what you do.
I've worked in movie theaters my whole life. We were there at 3 a.m. and we were going crazy by 3 a.m.
Yeah.
That is a good kind of crazy. Like, you know, playing javelin with brooms from the front of the theater. See if we can hit the projection window. Unfortunately, that kind of like goofy camaraderie is absent from this movie.
It's a very better film.
Yeah, it's also cheap. It's done on the fly. It looks like they were filming in the store after hours, after the manager actually went home, and they're sneaking in and filming this movie, and hoping that the blood doesn't stain. Yeah, there's a pair of pants there. Somebody tries it on surreptitiously, and it ends up like cinching her and biting her in half.
Awesome.
In the women's restroom.
There's another guy who gets his hands bitten off by the teeth in the zipper.
Yeah, and we see, like, he eats away at his hands, spurts his fingers, then his hands. Somebody else tries it on, and unfortunately, the gore effects were perhaps too expensive to show, because a lot of the actual kill or gore is, like, just off camera.
I feel like if this movie were made in the 80s, and there's really no reason why it couldn't have been. Mm. Like, you... cell phones are removed from the equation anyway.
Yeah.
Like, this movie was made in the 80s.
When designer jeans were a thing, so it could have been made.
If the movie were made in the 80s, I think two things are true. One, Paul Bartel would have been in it. Two,
there's Mary Warrenoff. She just appeared next to him.
Yeah, they would have totally been in this movie. And two, we would have seen more gore. And the gore would have been a little funnier, I think, because this movie has a sense of humor. I don't want to make this seem like this is just this dour, like, mean. It's mean spirited, but I think it's mean spirited with like a direction, like it's aiming at something. So I'm fine with it. But it just feels like when you think about the gore in something like Stuart Gordon's Reanimator,
which is
like
plentiful, by the way,
it's extremely gory, but the gore is a certain kind of like silly charm to it. Like, oh, I just cut off this guy's head. It keeps falling off of my desk. Well, I'll just use this, like, needle I use to keep, like, notes on my desk. I'll just shove the head on that. It's creative. It works. And there's something just very drolly humorous about that kind of gore. And this doesn't really have that. This is, the gore is actually taken in a kind of a brittle way. And the humor is all about how corporate capitalism is, if you're not careful, very close to fascism. The pants in question are called, like, I think they're called like super shapers, and they have a marked SS on them. Like, it's not subtle. It's not subtle.
This sort of like anti-corporate messaging is something that was also really common in the 80s. Yeah. I compare this to the remake of Child's Play. The original Child's Play was a very direct critique on hot kids toys.
Yeah. Well, Gremlins like 2 was a toys. Merciless corporate satire.
Yeah, specifically of like Trump and Ted Turner.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was, that was the 90s, but yeah.
Barely. It was made in the 80s.
There was a lot of just, you know, the stuff, speaking of Larry Cohen movies.
Great example.
Where products were the things that were going to kill you.
Yeah.
And Slacks is just sort of cribbing from that. And there's definitely something salient about it because it keeps on going on. And even though the language in terms of like marketing and the way we sell things has changed dramatically to the point where a lot of the marketing language is about how responsible the company is in sourcing their materials and who makes it. And, you know,
we're such a responsible company. Everything we do is organic and that's why you should buy from us. And it doesn't actually matter if it's true to them.
It doesn't matter if it's true to them, and it doesn't matter if it's true at all. In fact, a lot of it is just spin corporate lies or a way to... It's like when companies started putting the word all natural on their food products. It didn't mean anything, all natural. It just means like one less peptide was manipulated in a lab.
Yeah.
And now the word organic is on everything, which just replaced all natural. A lot of it's, look, I can get organic... chocolate covered popcorn. Oh, great. So it's better for me now. No. So a lot of this responsible marketing language is now laid sort of bare as being pretty hypocritical. That's kind of the only update from something that would have been made 40 years ago.
Yeah.
That said, it's still pretty fun. I appreciate when they can make a silly monster film about a killer pair of pants on a budget. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of wonderful shots of the pants walking around by themselves.
Yeah, that's always hilarious.
Yeah. And they didn't just put, like, someone in pants and blue screen out their body. They actually, like, puppeteered the pants.
Mm-hmm. Although they did end up blue screening. Green screening that.
But it's done with puppetry rather than CG.
No, it looks so much better than that. Yeah, I actually dug this movie. Mm-hmm. It's a lean, mean 77 minutes. There's not a lot of fat on it. Mm-hmm. It's exactly what you think it's going to be. And again, I think, speaking to someone who I've had positive experiences working retail, I've had negative experiences working retail. And my negative experiences working retail, I know exactly the mood one would be in to write this screenplay after you got home from work. Like, it's 1 a.m. I just had to take the bus home and I have to do another shift in the morning, but by God, I have another half hour of material for Slacks. I'm gonna write it down. And I dug it. It's not an instant classic territory, but it is very entertaining. It is actually taking the opportunity to take a silly concept like killer pants and actually be about something, and I think it successfully does so. So I dig it. It's on Shudder right now. It's a Shudder exclusive, and yeah, if you like horror comedies, it's definitely worth checking out.
And I'm interested in other things that this director has done. Her name is Elsa Kefhart, and she's a Canadian film director. And I'm just looking over some of the titles she's done, like Graveyard Alive, A Zombie Nurse in Love, or Beyond the Pearly Gates of Ill Repute. These are films I want to see.
Yeah, that's a very... that sounds like a list of your, like, best films of the year. Like, if you just told me, like, those are your films, I'd be like, I must have missed those. Yeah, that sounds like win.
Be sure to see Beyond the Pearly Gates of Ill Repute.
Well, tell me about... Okay, so there's one movie you saw that... Only one this week. There's only one movie you saw this week that I didn't.
Okay.
We'll save Justice League for last. Let's talk about Rose Plays Julie.
Rose Plays Julie is an... I suppose it's a thriller. It's an Irish thriller about a young woman. She's a veterinary student, and she seems really kind of, she lives in this sort of cold, sorry, let me turn off my buzzer. This cold, sort of cold, detached world. And we learn early on that she has tracked down her birth mother. She recently, before the events of the film, learned that she had been adopted and was found that her birth mother, who is now a working actress, sort of a recognizable face, and she kind of begins at first stalking her. She knows her phone number. She calls her up and just sort of says hello, and they don't know what's going on. She ends up haunting around the film sets where her birth mother is hanging out, and ends up looking for a tour of her birth mother's home. Her birth mother put her home on for sale. So she ends up taking a tour and very slowly kind of integrates her way into a position where she can have a conversation with her birth mother. And it all seems very creepy. Like, we don't know what her motives are here. She seems very, very much like a stalker, but at the same time, it's really understandable. She's actually really curious and is perhaps just a bit shy about approaching this woman, trying to ask more about sort of where she came from and why she was put up for adoption. And at the end of the first act, after about 30 minutes, we do learn why, in a very terse conversation, we learned that she was the product of a sexual assault. And I'm not going to say anything more that happens after that, but a lot of this deals with how she's trying to process all of this information.
Yeah.
She only recently learned that she was adopted.
Yeah.
And that sort of threw her for an emotional loop. And now that she was sort of the product of a violent act is also now sort of putting her whole existence into question. And she starts to take on this different personality, this other role, to continue through the following actions of the movie. Maybe in a way to detach and like sort of remove herself from a lot of this emotion, or maybe with a more pointed purpose. And I don't want to say which it is because I want the surprises to remain.
You mentioned initially that it seemed like a kind of like a stalker. You kind of said, almost like for like a thriller. It's not a thriller though, is it?
Well, it's shaped like a thriller. It feels like a thriller, but it's really also a very quiet movie. And a lot of the bigger emotional moments come in moments of silence. So I can't say it's not like a De Palma film where everything's just really wild and all the stalker and all the camera angles. But at the same time, it's not completely understated. It's not like, it's not really subdued, but I'm going to compare it to a Claire Denis film because they give us sort of information a little bit out of order. We see a scene and then we see it sort of replayed again almost immediately thereafter from a slightly different angle. Conversations happen where we get the important information first and then we go back to leading up into the information. So all of these big moments of confrontation are kind of fragmented. And I think that's the way your memories tends to work, especially right after you've experienced some really intense moment. You remember the really intense moments and the other moments kind of cluster around it. And I think the director is really, really good about sort of constructing those intense emotional moments. It does end up going in kind of a more, I don't want to say predictable, but a more recognizable thriller direction after a while. It's always kind of a pity when a film eventually sort of solidifies, because I always enjoy being a little bit lost in the mystery of it.
Yeah. But there comes a point where even if you don't begin mathematically, there's this general sense of, there's only so much more left of the movie. We have to start wrapping things up a little.
Yeah.
And it can sometimes feel a little inorganic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a shame. But it sounds like a good movie, though?
It's quite good, but it's a little intense. It was directed by two directors named Joe Lawler and Christine Malloy, who I've never heard of before. But yeah, they are able to sort of take sort of a lot of well-worn genre ideas, but turn them into something a little bit slipperier and a little bit more emotionally resonant.
Yeah, sounds very good.
Yeah, I dug it.
You know what I dug?
What did you dug?
Quo Vadis, Aida.
This is an Oscar nominee.
This is an Oscar nominee. This is nominated for Best International Feature at this year's Academy Awards. This movie fucked me up, but in a really, really good way, though. Like, like, thank you for putting me through this, even though it was incredibly harrowing. Kind of way. This comes from a director. I hope I'm not going to butcher her name too badly, but Yasmila Zbanek. And this is a film about the Srebrenica genocide in 1995. If you were around, you might recall it being on the news a lot, and certainly some of you are international and you actually are familiar with international events better than most Americans are. But the Bosnian conflicts of the 1990s was really brutal. And there is an incident in a town called Srebrenica. Again, I'm hoping I'm not pronouncing this too incorrectly, Srebrenica, where the army took all the men and killed all the men. And it's horrifying. And this movie is about a UN translator named Aida. It's about... she's responsible for translating what the UN is telling the people of Srebrenica and how they're saying, like, hey, you know, you've been saying that, like, things are going to be okay and you're going to give them an ultimatum, and if they move one more inch, there's going to be airstrikes. And that you've never done that, actually. Mm-hmm. You've never actually followed through on any of these things, and they know it, and they just keep pushing forward. But it's going to be okay, right? And she's responsible for telling them it's going to be okay. And then... the army comes into town, everyone gets pushed out, and thousands of people converge on the UN headquarters, seeking asylum. And the UN is essentially powerless. They can make threats, but they cannot make good on them. They have guns, they're not allowed to shoot them. They don't have the facilities to take care of everybody, and the army could just bomb them and kill them all, and that's that. And this woman, Aida, is basically doing every single thing she can. She can't save everybody. She's just trying to save her own family and do the right thing in the process as much as possible for everyone else. So it's all about her just desperately trying to manipulate the system, trying to make sure everyone she's ever known, worked with, shared a cigarette with, is in a position to try to help her out. And you realize just how helpless the situation it is. And as the buses start coming up and they start saying, hey, everybody get on the buses. And everyone's like, finally, we can go. And Aida's like, no,
don't get on those buses.
Don't do that. It's absolutely fucking terrifying.
Yeah.
It's a terrifying film.
It's terrifying watching just the world fall apart around Aida.
And like practically in real time, a lot of it. Yeah.
And it shows that these things that have been set up for crises, these institutions that have been set up to handle a major military crisis and major humanitarian crises, are actually not prepared for when one actually hits. They haven't thought out the practicalities of it. And
they haven't thought out what it's like when people aren't interested in diplomacy. And so we have all we can do is be diplomatic. And if you actually say, we don't care, we'll shoot you, then all we can do is kind of lay down and say, okay,
step
go
aside.
Ahead. Yeah. And you see these UN people knowing what's going on and knowing that they're completely powerless to do anything about it. And, I hate them because, my God, you're doing nothing. You're doing nothing at all.
Yeah, and
at all.
It shows that a lot of these institutions are set up under the assumption that people will behave honorably.
Yeah.
And when a military coup is underway and we get to see the military guys, you know, with their body armor and their machine guns walk smugly up, prepared to murder anybody and not caring, you realize that nothing is going to work. None of these things are going to work. This is doomed for death. And as Aida experiences the mounting dread that nothing can be done and the utter denial that she can do anything to change it, is just wrenching. And we get to see the result of the military coup. And then there is a fast forward near the end where we get to see the coda.
The coda devastated.
Yeah, which, you know, what happened several years later.
Not going to tell you anything about that.
No.
But that devastated me. As much as I thought I was done being devastated, I'm like, what more can this movie possibly throw at me? And then I'm like, oh, shit. Damn, this is a good movie.
Yeah,
this is a riveting motion picture. It's based on a true story. It's not fun. There's nothing fun about this. But my goosebumps had goosebumps as I'm watching this movie, because it is so, like, ingeniously captures this sense of helplessness and that really horrifying awareness that as we are watching it, society is crumbling. Mm. Like, human decency is failing and evil is winning right now,
yeah.
This second, and the powerlessness to help while you are incredibly motivated to do so.
Yeah.
And Jesus Christ, this is so fucking good. This is just a really brilliant motion picture. I don't have like a lot more to say about that other than this is going to be a really tough watch for a lot of people. And if you don't think you can handle something like that, I totally get that. If you can, I think this is a must see. I really do. This is an incredibly powerful motion picture. This is an incredibly well-made motion picture. It's based on a true story, but it doesn't feel like, you know, Hollywood biopic claptrap. This is really like important, illuminating cinema. And I just flabbergasted by it. I was so overwhelmed by it. I just, damn.
I thought it was a nightmare.
Yeah.
Just one of those films to make you breathe fast. It was, it reminded me of a lot of the films we see in the short film categories.
Yeah.
Where there's some sort of military or humanitarian crisis. And, in the short film categories, we usually get like a setup of a real world event or something really just horrendous that is set up. And then there's like, for lack of a better word, a punchline, like a setup and a payoff. And here we actually get to see it played out. We actually see the drama and the dread mounting. And rather than just sort of setting us up and then punching us, it keeps on fainting around us as if it's not going to. And then, of course, it does, and it pounds you mercilessly. It's a really tough watch.
But I think very good.
Quite good.
Yeah, but it's tough. It's tough. There's no denying that it's tough. But, you know, I think there are times when it's worth it. And as someone who often avoids really, really horrible, like, you know, confrontational, emotional things, just because of my own histories of mental health and stuff, this isn't the sort of thing I would normally ever like seek out, like for, you know, just, oh, let's watch this tonight, that kind of thing. But I'm so glad I saw this. I'm genuinely glad I saw this. And I guess I cannot recommend it enough, even though it may be a tough watch.
Yeah.
Then there was the superhero movie.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah.
So in 2017, Zack Snyder, who had previously directed Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice, made Justice League. That was the whole idea. They were going to repeat the Marvel formula where they're going to put all the superheroes in one movie. They made Justice League. And during production, the studio started to get like cold feet, from what I understand. Well, I don't know the exact narrative.
I can give you the gist. Basically, Batman v Superman underperformed. The critics were, you know, it was a divisive film. Some people really liked it. A lot of people really didn't like it. And Warner Brothers started saying, hey, can we maybe adjust the tone on this one and make it a little bit more like, you know,
a little brighter.
And apparently Zack Snyder was not against that in principle. But then, so they started messing with his vision a little bit. And then what happened was
they were rewriting the script, which happens on a lot of movies.
I didn't find that in and of itself remarkable. That happens all the time. But then a family tragedy occurred and Zack Snyder was grieving and he left the project. And Warner Brothers, which, you know, wanted to get the film out on time, raced to replace him with Joss Whedon, who had recently done Avengers and Avengers Age of Ultron, which are these two giant superhero blockbusters. And the initial idea was that Joss Whedon was just going to finish it, maybe add a couple of little things. And it turns out he or the studio, and I assume the studio had a lot of hand in this, dramatically reworked the film. Truncated it significantly.
It was the studio. I doubt Joss Whedon stepped in and said, okay, here's how it's going to be to
work. Oh, yeah, I'm sure he didn't do that, but I'm sure he was doing the studio's bidding, but it also does feel like a lot of the additions and changes are very Whedon-y. There's a lot more banter in the theatrical cut. The music is very, very different. It's a lot less Snyder-y. Danny Elfman did a score that was a bit more evocative of previous scores for Superman the movie and Tim Burton's Batman.
Which he also did the score for.
Yep. He
reused his own theme.
Yes, he did.
For Batman in Justice League.
But he ended up reshooting significant parts. The result was a movie that was significantly shorter than what we now call the Snyder Cut. Was functionally very similar. The structure of it's basically the same.
It's the same story.
It's the same basic story, but it's lot shorter. And I have two schools of thought on this. Mm. One is, hey, which one's better? Mm. And if you're asking me for that answer, I would answer the Snyder Cut, even though I have issues with it. But it's also a question of, if this had been the version we got in the first place, how happy would we have been?
Yeah.
And I think we would have been like, that's okay.
Yeah,
but I think I think it's a lot better than the theatrical cut. So
I think
that's true.
I think in terms of like filmmaking, it's a better film. They expanded it. I think the pacing is really bad. It's a 4-hour film. They kind of drag things out, and it takes a long time to get going.
I think the first two hours of the movie are slow.
Yeah, but they expand a lot of the characters' roles. They added a new character, which is really notable, in the form of Darkseid. It turns out there was a big bad above the villain from the original Justice League.
Which was implied in the original movie, and if you knew the comics, you knew that that was a thing. Mm. But here it's discussed more openly, and you do get to see Darkseid a couple of times.
Yeah, they completely reanimated the villain. And in the original, he was a CGI guy. Now he's just a bigger CGI guy. It's functionally the same character, but now he looks bigger and scarier.
I rewatched the theatrical cut before I watched the Snyder Cut. Mm. Just because I wanted to have it fresh in my head, because maybe rose-colored glasses, maybe I was too kind. Maybe I was a little too kind when it came out, because that movie's a mess. I don't hate all of it, but that movie is a mess. Everyone was talking about, Steppenwolf looks terrible. He's going to look so much better in the Snyder Cut. Mm. He does look terrible in the actual cut. There's no denying that. He looks a slightly different kind of terrible in the Snyder Cut.
He still looks terrible. He's like covered with butter knives. Like his armor is always fluttering.
His whole armor is made with staples. Like it looks weird and his face is still weird and unconvincing. Like it's not a good performance.
It's not like with the character of Thanos is very similar, where they got a lot of like CGI on Josh Brolin's face
to get his acting.
So there's he's a CGI creation, but he looks a lot more natural. And I think they just animated this guy from whole cloth, so he doesn't have those natural facial movements.
I got that impression from rewatching the theatrical cut that maybe that was what they wanted initially was for the theatrical cut to have the actor Kieran Hines, who voiced the character in both versions. They wanted the performance to come out more, but they just didn't have time to do it good.
Yeah.
Because I actually feel like Steppenwolf in some ways is actually a better facial acting performance. He just looks stupider. He's wearing like goofy shorts. Like he just doesn't... Both versions look bad. Both versions are not a good looking villain. And Steppenwolf is never an interesting villain. He's guy from space who's tough, but he's not the main bad guy. We learn a little bit more about why he's doing what he's doing in this one. It's still not important. He's just the big tough guy they can't beat until the end. He's not a good villain. That's one problem the movie has regardless.
And the plot in both are the same. We have Steppenwolf who wants to assemble three magical widgets. They're called Mother Boxes. And when he does, he can terraform Earth and turn it into his home planet for he and his other evil, magical space badasses.
And turn every single living creature on Earth into what is called a parademon, which are basically like bug dudes.
They look like guys at cons, wear like ghost costumes. And in order to defeat these bad guys, Batman, played by Ben Affleck, has to travel the world assembling the Justice League, which is Aquaman, Wonder Woman, The Flash... And they have to Cyborg, most notably Cyborg, and then they have to also resurrect Superman, who died.
Yeah.
And in fact, the opening scene of this cut of the movie is Superman dying, and his death wail is the thing that activates the Mother Box. That feels like something that they made up at the last minute.
That's something that it feels like it's a big fucking deal, but when you watch it, it's actually like, this is... kind of absurd, like the way you're doing this. Like
they're trying to cover something that they forgot to write.
There's this whole plot about the backstory here, and this is kind of in the theatrical cut. It's a bit more in detail now. Is that a long time ago, Darkseid in the Snyder cut it's Darkseid and the theatrical cut it's Steppenwolf, came to Earth, tried to conquer it then. And like an ancient times. Yeah, and an alliance between Amazons, Atlanteans, humans, the Greek gods, and the Green Lanterns teamed up to fight him off. And they did. We're the only planet to ever successfully do that. It is now thousands of years later, and Darkseid forgot where we were. He accidentally left three mother boxes here.
Space is big, all right? It's easy to get lose track of a planet.
This is the only planet where they kicked your ass. Maybe you'd remember the address, but like, oh, don't stay away from Boylston Street. You gotta, everyone's real tough on Boylston Street or whatever street. I don't know. Boylston Street's the name of a poem in the movie The Freshman. I don't know why I zeroed in on that.
Weird piece of trivia. It has
nothing to do with anything. Where was I going with you? So yeah, so Darkseid just forgot that Earth was here. They left mother boxes here, and they've been looking for them ever since. And then Steppenwolf finds it by chance. And the whole thing is, the mother boxes activate because without Superman, Earth is without a protector. Which begs the question...
Where was Steppenwolf all the hundreds of millennia before Superman came along?
Yeah, because they even say just like... Well, like, yeah, well, you know, the cyborg was created before Superman died. Why didn't the Mother Box say anything then? It's because Superman was protecting Earth. Superman's been here for a couple of decades. You had thousands of years. Really? And it's a little thin. I'm not saying there isn't some, like, you could, like, wrap your head around, come up with a bunch of, like, you know, sort of fan reasons why this all makes sense and get yourself a no prize. Knock yourself out. But my point is that the plotting is a little thin. it's a little arbitrary and contrived.
Which is really a pity when you're, you know, sitting down to watch a 240-minute film. If you're going to have 4 hours of superhero nonsense, make that way more... Well, actually, don't make it complicated, because then you have something like Batman versus Superman.
No, we don't want complicated. We want full. And that's the thing. The second half of this movie, but when the Justice League finally comes together, and that's 2 hours into the movie, when the Justice League
The first one was over at this point.
Pretty much. When the Justice League finally gets together, I'm going to say it right now, except for the epilogue, which I'll talk about in a second, I think the movie is great. I think the last 2 hours of this movie, except for the epilogue, are actually, like, they fly right by, okay? Everything's paced better, the action is a little cooler, all the stuff that they added is actually kind of neat, you know, we had this whole heist thing that gets, like, really boosted in this version, and there's a lot more drama with Cyborg. Cyborg has tons of footage that was left on the cutting room floor. Like, it's an insult. Like how much they just completely ignored this character in the theatrical cut. Yeah, he was the heart and soul of the movie. So I think that the last 2 hours are kind of shallow because they're really just only about, like, the characters feel stuff, but there's no really theme being explored here. Yeah. But they're fun and they're dense and they were a good time at the movies. The first 2 hours is just them assembling the Justice League and talking about it. And you could totally have cut that down by 45 minutes to an hour. You absolutely, very easily could have done that without sacrificing the good stuff. And there's good stuff in there. There's the new stuff with Cyborg in particular is great. But there's also a lot you can trim.
Here's what you needed. Darkseid, I suppose his inclusion did change the motivation of the bad guy a little bit.
Yeah.
He's still a generic and bad-looking character, but at least he was there to sort of placate his boss, who is also his nephew.
Also, it suggests that this is not the end of the story, and it gives you room to grow as a franchise, if that's what you want to do.
Surely is. Darkseid and Steppenwolf look so similar that you could just switch them. It's like, who cares? They don't have, like, very different personalities. I think if you included all of, like, the Cyborg stuff in the theatrical cut, it would have just been a much broader, breathier sort of movie. I think that's the middle ground we wanted. Because I think a lot of the character stuff was underserved, and I liked all of the new character stuff with Cyborg.
Yeah, that sounds great. Morton is really, really great.
Joe Morton plays Cyborg's dad, and he was, as we saw at the end of Batman v Superman, he used the Mother Box to resurrect his son, who was recently killed in an accident, and but it like built this robot body around him, so he doesn't really have a human body anymore. Just like part of his head is the only thing that survived. And now he has to deal with this sort of Frankenstein complex where he's like, I'm kind of a monster now. What do I do in the human world? And he's sort of like the tortured character and not Batman. Isn't that a relief?
It actually is. And that's something you notice is that a lot of the stuff in the theatrical cut foregrounds Batman more. And in the Snyder cut, it does feel more like an ensemble. And I actually like that. It feels like the first one is all about, will Batman be able to get this thing together? And will Batman be able to convince Wonder Woman that she should lead the team? And it's actually, this one just feels a bit more like just everyone gets their time. Sometimes I wish they didn't. I will say this. I think the new introduction of the Flash, where he saves Iris's life, but also takes a moment while she's helpless to kind of like fondle her hair is really weird. And then he steals a hot dog right next to her, which is really, really weird. All of that stuff is just tonally weird. You don't need that scene.
Plus, it's a joke we saw already twice with the character of Quicksilver in the X-Men movies. And those were a lot more entertaining, quite frankly.
That's not my issue with it. But I think the scene is extraneous. I don't think you need it. I don't think it works. I think that there's some extra stuff with Wonder Woman finding out about Darkseid you don't really need.
I like the scenes in the theatrical cut where Wonder Woman did have discussions as to who's going to be the leader of the team, and Batman says, we need a leader. It's not me. I'm Batman. I can't do that sort of thing. I just don't know how.
But I brood in a cave.
But clearly you do, and so, you know, the idea that the Justice League is going to have Wonder Woman as its leader is, you know, a concept that's not in the Zack Snyder version.
It's interesting there's this whole version of the movie that's going to be largely disregarded now, and I don't think everything in that version is crap. There's a couple of things I actually kind of miss. Not a lot. I still think this is the better version. But the things that I miss, I think, like, three things. And if you put them in the movie, I would have been like, yay, that's nice. But I'm not at a loss for them not being there. There's a bit where they're about to go into action for the first time, and the Flash acknowledges that he's never actually done battle before.
Yeah.
He's like, stopped a mugging, but, like, the guy's just a normal dude, so it's kind of like shooting fish in a barrel. He's actually really nervous, and there's a solid bit of dialogue in the theatrical cut that's Batman telling the Flash, just save people. Save one person. Then when you're done, you'll know that was the right thing to do, and you'll do more, and that's that. That was actually a good little beat, and I kind of liked that beat. I liked the bit at the end where Superman and the Flash decided to have a race. I thought that was actually ending it on kind of like a fun note. Like, now that the team is assembled, like, we can actually enjoy ourselves a little bit with these characters. Like, we've gone through these, like, growing pains, and, like, people have been, like, dark, and now they've found themselves, and it feels like we're in a good place. That part I kind of liked. I also liked, and this is something I actually would have thought that Zack Snyder shot, just based on how it was filmed in the theatrical cut. There's a montage at the beginning of the theatrical cut that's basically showing that with Superman dead, the world is in mourning and they don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like hope is lost. We've lost this God that protected us. And even if you didn't trust him because of all the stuff that happened in Man of Steel and Batman v Superman, he martyred himself for the world. He killed himself to save the world. And now everyone feels really bad about that. So it's this big, giant montage of people grieving and anger stoking and, you know, a world that is not just the superheroes were affected, but every human being was affected. And I actually thought that was kind of a good way to get the story started, is to give it some context.
Rather than just Superman's death wail activating the plot.
Yeah, that's a minor thing. And again, you know, if I'd never known the other one existed, I might not know I missed it. But it's it. But that's it. Like, this, like, three little moments that I liked from the theatrical cut that I kind of miss here. But there's so much stuff here that I think is so much better. Like, there's this early bit with Cyborg where he discovers the extent of his, like, cybernetic powers, and he uses them to help a struggling single mother out
by hacking an ATM.
I actually thought that whole bit was like, hey, heroism. Remember that shit? Remember people used to do that?
The only problem is, because this is Zack Snyder, he communicates that through what is essentially just a montage.
Yeah.
So it feels like an aside, not like him discovering something really exhilarating for the first time.
Perhaps not, but I did like it. I thought it was better than not having it. I'm trying to think what else. There's a couple of, like, weird moments, and I kind of like that there are weird moments, but I also kind of roll my eyes at some of them. The biggest weird one of all for me is when we first are introduced to Lois Lane in this version. We see her, she's like getting coffee and she's visiting like the monument to Superman as part of her grieving process. The camera, she's like walking in slow-mo down the street and the camera tilts down and you see a cover of the Daily Planet. And the cover of the Daily Planet, the front page banner headline is, I wrote it down, sorry. It was Gotham Security Bank Seeks New Architect. And I'm looking at this headline.
Must have been a really slow news day.
I'm looking at this headline, I'm like, what are you trying to convey with this headline? Because movies tend to convey information with headlines. That's common use of exposition.
In fact, headlines never sound like headlines in movies because they're just exposition.
Yeah.
I bet newspaper headline writers or copy editors just bristle whenever they see a movie newspaper.
Perhaps, but at the same time, you know, that's what we expect. So when we see a newspaper headline, we think, oh, some information is about to be conveyed. Oh, maybe we're going to find out that the Daily Planet is closing down or, you know, there's going to be a memorial to Superman. It's going to be important in the next scene or something. Mm. And instead, it's a banner headline about how a bank needs an architect. That's page 3 of the business section. That is not page 1. So my first thought was, okay, so I remember in the theatrical cut, Lois Lane said that she was like taking a step back from like hard-nosed reporting and just kind of writing some fluff pieces. So maybe this is just to suggest that with Lois Lane not doing the tough work, the Daily Planet just doesn't have good news anymore. And I'm like, no, news still happens in the world. I guarantee Perry White is actually like a good editor. Like he will find the story today and it won't be a bank is hiring right now. Like, no, he's going to,
you know, you don't know what kind of weird sort of contentious battle for architecture there was in Gotham City at the time. Maybe I.M. Pei like had designed something and started building it. And it just, there was a big fallout or somebody, there was like a big scandal. So this could just be the most recent step in a larger scandal.
And if it's a scandal, you're going to find a more salacious headline than Gotham Security Bank Seeks New Architect.
No, I suppose you're right.
You know, Gotham Bank Seeks Architect Amidst Scandal is enough for, it's not great, but it's better than that. And it turns out, someone explained this to me online, it turns out that that is nothing more than a reference to the Fountainhead.
Oh, God. Zack Snyder
almost directed. I guess it's not on the table anymore. It might still be, but he was working on an adaptation of The Fountainhead. And this is his little reference to The Fountainhead.
The Fountainhead is an Ayn Rand novel about an architect who's
refuses to compromise.
Work is taken away from him, and doesn't want to compromise to those in charge because he's just that talented and strong.
And I can see some parallels here with maybe people thinking that like, oh, Zack Snyder's vision was compromised, and at the same time, it's like, okay, even if I allow for that, that's a stupid headline. Mm. That's just and you're focusing on that. It's just this weird moment. It's not a big deal. Mm. It's just indicative of the kind of like just occasional weirdness that'll pop up in this movie. Mm. I kind of liked the sea chanty for Aquaman.
All of these little things that they've added, you know, even bigger things like adding new characters or expanding Cyborg's backstory don't make the film any more entertaining is the problem. It's a better put together film. It's better thought out.
I cared about Cyborg, I guess.
Yeah, I might care about the characters a little bit more, or at least in a different sort of way. But at the end, it's just a big superhero fight. They're not exploring new, bigger, more interesting themes. Zack Snyder doesn't have something on his mind that wasn't in the theatrical cut. It was all just style and fashion. So I found the theatrical cut to be perfectly entertaining. It was shabby. It looked kind of bad, and they had to sort of reshoot a lot of things at the last minute, and you could tell. But it had a sort of sloppy Saturday morning kind of vibe to it. It had this sort of like afternoon entertainment tone to it, and which I appreciated. You know, it just felt like I think the issue a lot of people had is that it did not feel like this big epic coming together the same way the Avengers film did. Mm. It felt like something light and fun. And it was light and fun, and I had an okay time with it. I don't have problems with the theatrical cut, frankly. It's serviceable. This one is longer. It's a better put together, but I'm getting the exact same amount of entertainment value out of it.
Mm.
I like them the same.
They
over-constructed it. They made it into this big, perfect machine, but it's a machine that does the same thing that the original one did.
I don't think that's true. For me, right. I think I agree that they're functionally similar movies. Mm. Again, the structure is basically the same. I think that when you've actually got a consistent visual and sort of emotional tone, I think that helps. That does wonders with actually. Keeping my engagement as opposed to constantly being distracted by weird jarring things. So I think that helps. I think it helps that I was more invested in the story. Maybe not a lot more invested, but noticeably more invested. So I did care. I was getting more out of it, even though it's a lot of it's the same stuff. I think, where was I going with this? Got the original, it's kind of sloppy, but it was like sort of fine. And this one, yeah, I think this one still has problems. I think the pacing is off, just off. It feels like an assembly cut. It feels like they just put everything they had in here and they didn't actually edit it down for pacing or anything. It feels it feels really indulgent, which is something that I think we can safely say about Zack Snyder's movies. But yeah, I actually
100%.
I actually think something that saves this film is the fact that unlike Batman v Superman, and a lot of other Zack Snyder movies, actually. Not all of them. He doesn't have anything on his mind. And that's something that I actually think does Zack Snyder a disservice. He's not a particularly, like, nuanced storyteller. Yeah, I'm not saying he's a bad storyteller. But what I am saying is that he doesn't seem particularly interested in subtlety or complexity. He's interested in big ideas. And when he's only doing a movie about big ideas, that's great. That's totally fine. But I actually feel like the over-the-top way in which he presented the story of The Watchmen actually undercut the human drama of The Watchmen, which was not as broad as his presentation. Whereas here, this movie is about next to nothing. This movie is about, hey, you know, Justice League is kind of like gods. And I'm like, yeah, that's it. And I'm like, okay, cool. So they're just going to
explore some theological theme here.
We're just going to do some cool superhero shit. And I'm like, okay, this is cool superhero shit. I'm not complaining. This is cool. Thank you for this. This is fine. So I did get a kick out of it. I could definitely have done without the nightmare epilogue, which is it feels like a parody of a Zack Snyder joint. It does.
Because there was a portion in Batman v Superman where Batman fell asleep and had, like, it's supposed to be a nightmare, but it's also like this premonition as to what the world will look like. And there's a big Omega, which you explained to me was the dark side symbol, the letter Omega. And yeah, it's like shooting guns and wearing a suit and everything's destitute and desert-like. And
Superman's gone
and
evil.
And then there's an evil Superman now. And then rather confusingly, he woke up and immediately saw the Flash poke his head in from the future. Which, when I saw the movie, I thought was just some random astronaut. I didn't recognize it as the Flash. It's like, so who the hell was that? There's no reference to that in Justice League until this epilogue, where it flashes forward to where Batman is now teamed up with Joe Manganiello, who's in there for some reason.
He plays Deathstroke the Terminator,
I don't know who Deathstroke
the Terminator is. He's the bad guy who was introduced at the end of the movie.
Yeah, he's just some guy's like, yeah, I want to work against Batman. And then there's this hard cut, and now he's working with Batman.
Yeah, it totally undersells that whole, like, dramatic intro of the Legion of Doom.
Jared Leto is there as the Joker, and he actually doesn't give the line of dialogue that was so mocked in the previews about, we live in a society that's given up on decency. They just sort of have a conversation. Batman mentions that he killed Harley Quinn and that he was going to kill the Joker next.
Yeah, he uses the F word like a badass.
Yeah, and then he says the F word and then the movie just ends. And that's the post-credits stinger.
That's like, you don't post-credits.
It should have been the post-credits stinger.
It's just, it's really long. It's really indulgent. It doesn't get us anywhere.
It's like 10 full minutes.
It's especially weird because nothing happens in it.
There's no action scene. They're standing on a freeway.
Nothing happens in this fucking sequence.
It's just Batman having a conversation.
It's just an excuse to get him there with the Joker. And apparently, this was the scene that they like shot like after like for the Snyder Cut. Like this is important to get in here, and I'm like, no, this doesn't help anything. I the one part I will disagree with you is I do think that the whole time travel thing, it's referenced earlier. There's a bit where the Flash says that if he approaches the speed of light, time gets wonky. And there's a bit where he has to go as fast as the speed of light in order to like supercharge the mother box and bring Superman back to life. And as soon as he does it, everyone gets a vision of the future in which they bring Superman back to life and he kills everybody. And they're like, wait, no, shit, it's too late now. That was actually a good bit. I thought that was a fun bit. I actually like all the new like Flash time travel stuff. I thought was actually kind of interesting. They don't go too far with it. It just they use it for a couple of good moments. They saved it for when they needed it. Again, this is a better version. Is it the best version? No. There's like a 3-hour, 15-minute version of this that hits the sweet spot. That's epic and big and gets all the good stuff in there. And there aren't a bunch of scenes that run long or completely superfluous. But I do like that this exists. I'm always interested in a director's cut. Even a director's cut sucks. I'm looking at you, Walter Hill's The Warriors. That's a director's cut that sucks. It's a takes a classic movie and makes it a bad movie. Like, don't do that. But it's always interesting to see the contrast. I think a lot of people are getting like an exciting look at like the nuances of editing this weekend. So that's cool.
You know, what I got out of watching this cut was... fans will do this sometimes. Well, on like DVD, they'll release deleted scenes alongside. It'll be packaged on the DVD. It's here's some scenes that didn't make the final cut. And sometimes a fan will take those scenes and edit them back in.
Yeah.
Just to see what the film would look like with all of them in. And lo and behold, the pacing sucks all of a sudden. And everything just comes to a crashing halt in every one of these scenes. It's the reason why these scenes are cut. This feels like somebody just put everything back in.
Yeah.
Just willy-nilly. Not with any sense of actual... pacing or actual film construction.
Yeah.
They just put it all in there. It's this big pile of superhero nonsense that rather disappointingly doesn't add up to anything more than what we already have.
No, it's weird for me is that ultimately the film's ambition, when you think about it, when you think about how it has to say about anything.
It was incredibly modest.
It was like in trying to be a 3, maybe 3.5-star blockbuster. Mm-hmm. Like that's what it was getting at. It's going to be a lot of spectacle. A lot of like fun character interactions and like a bunch of fight scenes. We're gonna fight inside a concrete tube, and then we're gonna fight inside a different concrete tube. Like that's where you have our whole story built on, and it's fun for that. But again, I think the question isn't which version is better. I think the question is if this was the version we had in the first place, what would we have said about it?
Been long and indulgent, and probably would have been bored.
Yeah, it's too long. Mm. It's incredibly indulgent. Boy, does that nightmare sequence not work. But I did mostly have a good time, and I would say that it's damn sight better than Batman v Superman, and probably a little better than Man of Steel, a movie which I mostly like, but I think whiffs the ending.
I don't like Man of Steel. I actually don't like Zack Snyder as a director. The fact that people were fighting for his quote vision always miffed me a little bit because I've seen his vision. I don't like his vision.
Yeah.
And he tends to make films that tout the greatness of fascism and sell this kind of Randian undercurrent and are really unhealthy views about female sexuality.
Sucker Punch
in particular.
I don't disagree with any of that. And what's weird is that he seems to be kind of oblivious to the fact that he's doing it.
Yeah.
That's what's weird about it. I don't understand at all how he can be totally like...
So it's
bizarre that he seems to be not aware of what he's doing.
I will say this. Even though he's the credited director on both cuts, Joss Whedon does not have a director's credit.
Yeah, he should.
He made a lot of it, but Zack Snyder has sole director credit on that. Yeah. This might be the best Zack Snyder film I've seen. I haven't seen his Owls film. I've heard that one's quite good.
I like that one a lot, actually. It's also fascist, but at least it's clear that fascists are bad.
Okay.
It's about fascism, but the fascists are clearly the bad guys in that one.
Fascist Owls.
As opposed to 300, where the fascists are the good guys.
This one seems to have a little bit more of a sense of fun, even in the Zack Snyder version. It's not as like ponderous and self-important as something like Man of Steel or Batman v Superman, which are insufferable. But I'm not I'm not getting a lot out of this movie. I'm not getting any more out of this movie than I had previously.
Yeah, it's weird.
So the original, the ambition was to be like a 3-star entertainment. I think the original was a 3-star entertainment.
Yeah.
I think this one is also a 3-star entertainment.
No, I think the original...
They spent $70 million and it's kind of a lateral move.
At the time, I was kind of kind to it because I liked the parts that I liked enough.
Yeah.
Revisiting it, the original theatrical cut... it's a mess. It's not an unentertaining mess. I don't hate it. I've grown to like a lot of sloppy films that were like mangled by studios before. So for me, it's like a 2, maybe 2.5 star movie.
All right.
This is a 3, 3.5 star movie, if I'm being kind. Mm. There's a lot of liking it. There really is. I'm glad it exists. If anyone's curious, because Whitney said he isn't really a fan of anything Zack Snyder did, Zack Snyder's really hot and cold with me. Okay. I think his Dawn of the Dead is really good. I think his Legend of the Guardians, the Owls of Cthulhu is really good.
Mm-hmm.
I think Man of Steel is mostly good. Okay. I think the parts that he gets so wrong that it hurts the film, but there's a lot of it that is genuinely very good. I think Batman v Superman stinks. I think 300 is well made, but irresponsible and in poor taste. And I think Watchmen is frustratingly mediocre.
Yeah.
Considering the talent he had in front of the camera, considering the material that he had, I feel the fact that he... The best I think I could say about The Watchmen is that he didn't completely screw it up. Like we were all talking about The Watchmen before it came out. Like, oh, The Watchmen, that's going to be like the Godfather of superhero movies. That's going to be the movie that changes it all. And then it came out, everyone's like, yeah, parts of it were right. And then we kind of forgot to talk about it for a couple of years. Like, well, that kind of says it all.
Well, but the problem with the Watchmen movie is the only way to really approach it was as a comparison to the work it was based on.
Yeah.
It's like, how does this compare to the book? It's like, well, how about you make a movie that is its own entity and you don't need to know the book? And everything was about comparing it to the source material rather than what it did correctly as a film.
Yeah. Anyway, that is Zack Snyder's Justice League. So we're going to review the new releases on our critically acclaimed scale. Once again, for anyone who's new, the critically acclaimed scale, we review films on a scale from C- to C+. The lowest you can get is a C- because that's below average, and that's anything that's below average. Mm. From we generally just don't particularly care for it to the worst thing ever made. A C is average. There's good and bad in it, or maybe it's good, but it's just not ambitious at all, and it's just sort of fine. And that's a C. That's average. Most movies are average. And then C+ is anything that's above average. From we recommend it to holy crap, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. Whitney Seibold, on its own, Zack Snyder's Justice League on the critically acclaimed scale.
It's a C. It's fine. It's fine. Despite its origin and despite all of the hoopla surrounding it, it's just okay.
Yeah. For me, there's about 2.5 hours of C+ in here, about a half hour of C-, and about an hour of... So I'm gonna average that down to a very high C.
All right.
I'm glad I saw it. I think it's definitely worth checking out, but whether or not you're going to fall in love with it is going to depend on how eager you were to do so, I think. But there's a lot of good in it, and I'm glad it exists. Quo Vadis, Aida?
That's a C+. It's really, really difficult to take. It's incredibly emotionally harrowing. There's a scene near the end where Aida holds her son's hand that broke my heart.
Yeah.
It'll break you. It'll threaten you. It'll make you sweat. And that's great filmmaking.
I agree. This is a C+ movie all the way. This is definitely one of the best films I've seen in quite a bit. Like at least the last few months. It's probably would have made, if it had come out a few months ago, it probably would have made my top 10 list last year. Technically, it's a 2020 release because it sells with the Oscars, yada, yada, yada. It's a little confusing.
It didn't come out.
I know.
It wasn't available until now.
It's a little confusing. Yeah. My point is this. It's really fucking good.
Mm.
And I hope you see it, even though it's really, really harrowing. Rose Plays Julie.
Rose Plays Julie is a... I feel like I need to think about it for a little while longer to really give it a proper grade, but I'm going to give it a high C for now.
Okay.
Definitely an appealing, interesting story.
And then last but not least, Slacks, SLAXX, the movie about killer pants. I don't know if I can give this anything but a C+. I really do. It's not just for audacity. Not even audacity. Just I think they take a silly premise and they end up making it work. I think there are definitely things that are holding it back from being instant classic, but I think it has a distinct point of view. I think it's funny. I think it has fun with its gore. Could have been gorier, and maybe that would have made the movie stronger. But yeah, I had a hoot with this. It's not an unequivocal recommendation, but it's a definite recommendation.
All right,
you?
I'll give it a C.
Nice.
It's an odd premise. It works well for an odd premise, and I do like those pants.
They're good pants.
Those are good pants.
Nothing better shows my taste than what I wear around my waist. Oh, pants.
Grar!
Pants! Sing the praises of pants. That's what Mystery Science Theater 3000. Anyway, it's time for the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club.
He'd go on if we let him.
I would. It's time for the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club. We review older movies that one or both of us haven't seen. Mm-hmm. This month, the theme was kind of anything on Paramount Plus. They don't have the best selection.
Yeah, we usually like to narrow it down with like a genre or a decade of some kind, but Paramount Plus's film selection is not great, so yeah. We just said, anything.
Anything, really. And so we gave our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork a bunch of options, and they voted for Infernal Affairs. Infernal Affairs is a 2002 Hong Kong movie directed by Andrew Lau and Alan Mack, starring Andy Lau and Tony Leung. Andy Lau plays a criminal. He was raised by criminals and was told to enter the police department so that he could be a mole for a crime organization.
It's the triad, specifically. It's the mob, yeah. It's organized crime.
And Tony Leung plays a police officer who is kicked out of the police, but it's actually all a ruse, so that he can work undercover in the triad. And then both of these people are assigned to find the mole in the organization and also to find the mole outside the organization. So they're hunting for each other and they're hunting for themselves. It's weirdly complicated, yet very efficient.
This version is really streamlined because The Departed is based on this. And yeah. This film made a lot of sort of like the midnight movie circuit when The Departed came out because people were curious about the source material.
Yeah. And the movie was a big hit. It won mm-hmm. awards. And I remember seeing this movie shortly after it came out and the DVD mm-hmm. started coming into America. And it was one of those movies where everyone was like, you got to see this movie, Infernal Affairs. It's a really, really great crime thriller. You got to check this thing out. Mm-hmm. And it was a big deal.
It's really twisty, but The Departed it's nearly 3 hours long. It's a long film. Martin Scorsese just expanded everything. And to the film's credit, it won a bunch of Academy Awards. This one is like 100 minutes, and it gets to the point way faster.
Yeah.
And so it has this complicated setup, but yeah, it's really, really streamlined, and we know exactly what's going on in every scene. Everything is set up to just sort of wring the ultimate amount of tension out of a scenario. There's a great set piece in the center where they're looking for the bad guys, and there's subtle ways of like sending Morse code to the Andy Lau character, or no, the Tony Leung character mm-hmm. is trying to send Morse code back to the cops without the Andy Lau character noticing, even though he's looking for it.
Yeah.
So there's like all of these like machinations as to who's looking for what all within this one scene where everything, you know, this big drug bust is about to happen.
I think the real genius of this movie is basically just the premise. Honestly, you get... They rang a bunch of really great set pieces out of it, but we've seen a lot of stories about undercover cops. Mm. We've seen Serpico, we've seen Donnie Brasco, and we've seen a lot of movies about corrupt cops. Mm. People are on the take, people are being bribed. The idea of the triad or the mafia or whatever, specifically picking a young criminal to enter the police force and be their mole from, like, birth. To have that ingrained loyalty to them. That was very distinct when Infernal Affairs came out. I don't think I'd ever seen that before, very specifically.
Yeah.
And it creates this weird idea of the police and the criminals are doing the exact same thing. It's not like we're on the opposite sides of morality, which is what a lot of cop movies are about. It's they're the exact same. And the idea that both the criminal and the cop, who are also simultaneously a cop and a criminal, are going through the exact same thing emotionally and having the exact same tension as they try to hunt for each other, but are also responsible for finding themselves, is... it's so fucking cool. It's such a fucking cool... And this movie is all of the set pieces from The Departed, none of the other stuff. It just goes from set piece to set piece. Mm. And they love those their set pieces. They luxuriate in their set pieces. They build to them with a lot of elegance. One thing that the Scorsese version did differently was they took a whole bunch of supporting female characters and made them all Vera Farmiga.
Yeah. They which dramatically, I suppose, is kind of interesting, where they took two separate female characters and had the two characters relate to the same character in a new way. So we got kind of...
Basically, Matt Damon is engaged to be married to a police psychologist played by Vera Farmiga, and Vera Farmiga is actually...
also the psychologist for Leonardo DiCaprio character.
Exactly, and Leonardo DiCaprio and her end up having an affair, and... bada bang, and that incorporates another small character from Infernal Affairs. Here, those are all distinct characters. I get what it's a process called dovetailing, where you take a couple of characters who maybe only have a couple of things to do, and you make them one character who has a lot to do and maybe more complex as a result. And I think Vera Farmiga is really good in The Departed, but it also makes her existence feel incredibly contrived. It really does feel like the fact that everything coincidentally revolves around her.
Yeah.
Ends up feeling kind of false. Whereas here, it just feels like there's a whole world out there, isn't there? Do you feel... it's hard not to compare this to The Departed. Because The Departed is very good.
It's very good, and I saw The Departed first. So that was sort of like my guidepost for watching Infernal Affairs. I think maybe if I had watched this for the first time, I might have had some trouble following it at first, just because it is a little bit of an ingenious but a complicated premise, where both characters are both cop and criminal simultaneously. Luckily, because I had seen The Departed, I had a handle on it right away.
Yeah, a bit of a primer. That's how I felt about watching The Departed, because I'd seen Infernal Affairs right away. I'm like, there's a lot going on here. I'm glad I saw Infernal Affairs. Infernal Affairs is just the absolute stripped-down, streamlined... jet engine version of The Departed.
The Departed is sort of this big, expansive crime epic that is all about organized crime in Boston and the way crime sort of affects the world at large. And it kind of, you get the sense that there's gigantic ripples being formed. There's an epic quality to it. All of that's gone out of Infernal Affairs. It's actually just like a really terse, taut cop thriller.
It's more of a Michael Mann joint. Guys doing their jobs.
I think a little bit more stylized than Michael Mann, who tends to be very kind of a cool filmmaker. But here it's just a really good crime film with a really interesting premise, and I really enjoy it. And it's the kind of thing that compared to other crime films from a similar time and place, seems just above and beyond. It's like head and shoulders above the others. Is it a cinema classic? Maybe not. It's quite a good film. It's a little curious that this was one that was chosen to be remade in America, out of all the other Hong Kong films you could have chosen.
I think it's got a great hook. I think that's why. I think it's clearly got a lot of material that can be mined for good performances. They really expanded the mafioso character. Jack Nicholson has like a whole supervillain to play with, and this guy is. He's a fun guy, but he's not the same kind of over-the-top character.
The character I like better was actually the character that ended up being played by Matt Damon in the remake, the Andy Lau character.
Oh, yeah, Andy Lau.
Because he actually does have this kind of... First of all, he's Andy Lau, so he's like super charming, but he does have this sort of conniving, underhanded quality to his performance, where he's playing every scene as if he's playing it two ways, and I think he does a really good job at that. Tony Leung is a little bit more of... not relaxed, but he's a little, because he's playing a criminal at all times, we never get any kind of sense as to sort of his interior monologue or what kind of emotional crisis he's going through.
Tony Leung's being very broody here, and I think Tony Leung is actually one of the better actors alive.
Oh, he's great.
He's so damn good, and I think Andy Lau is underappreciated, actually. Andy Lau is more of a... often considered a bit more of like a movie star, like almost like a, and this might just be my experience, but a bit more of like almost like a Tom Cruise kind of type. For me, the thing that was interesting is this movie was co-directed by Andrew Lau. Andrew Lau and Andy Lau that's not like he's directing it too. Like that's just a coincidence. Andrew Lau, like this was actually a big kind of turn for Andrew Lau. He had done like a lot of like over the top action movies. Like, have you ever saw The Storm Riders? You ever see that?
No.
Big, magical, epic martial arts adventure about guys who can do martial arts with water. And at one point, he's like, his own dad rips off his arm, so he has to use the blood to kill his own dad. And you're walking around like, this is cool, but what the fuck? This was like a big like shift, I think, for him. And at least in my experience, I haven't seen everything he did. He's a very prolific filmmaker. And yeah, this is very mature, I think. This is, again, it's brisk. again, this is just a bullet of a movie. But I really like it. This feels like a Don Siegel kind of film. It's just like this wonderful, brutal, macho efficiency to it. But it's not without a soul. It's not just pure bravado. It's actually like earns it all, I think. And I think actually, as little time as it takes, we get like a lot of like real heart and emotion out of this. We understand just how harrowing this journey that both of these people are on is in. There's a lot of talk, particularly in the prologue and epilogue, about sort of an eternal hell, a hell in which you're not allowed to die. And it's the idea that...
And hence the title, Infernal Affairs.
Well, that's the Americanization of it. I'm trying to remember, what is the... What is the Chinese version?
I don't remember.
The Unceasing Path.
There you go, which is a reference to Buddhism and the unceasing path of hell. It is hell is an unceasing thing.
Yeah. You're trapped in it. You're not allowed to leave. And so the idea that even... And it really mostly speaks to Andy Lau, but it also is about Tony Leung as well, which is they're in a bad situation and there is no conceivable way they're allowed to leave.
Yeah.
There's no hope. They cannot escape no matter what they do. If Andy Lau manages to get out of this, he's still going to be covering his tracks for the rest of his life. If Tony Leung gets out of this, he's still burned all his bridges and it's still awful. Like they made bad choices basically to go into these careers.
And unfortunately that kind of this idea of being eternally trapped in this, you know, circles of iniquity of this hell metaphor is only something that comes through in the title. I don't get that sense from actually watching the film. I think it's a little bit too busy with the mechanics than to really communicate that this is a trap for these people.
I feel like it's an attempt, and again, this is mostly in like opening narration. I feel like it's an attempt at least to take this, again, ruthlessly efficient and very exciting, but also in some respects very straightforward kind of thriller, and imbue it with a little gravitas. And I think that's something that Scorsese, in letting the story breathe a lot and letting it affect more characters and getting to know like this big giant ensemble a lot more and understanding a greater, you know, sort of web of tragedy, I think he gets more out of that because he has the freedom to do so. I was bummed, actually. I want to try to make the time this week, and I couldn't. I've actually never seen the sequels, Infernal Affairs 2 and Infernal Affairs 3, which have their fans. Infernal Affairs 2 is actually a prequel. It takes place when both of these cops were younger men, and they were just, like, getting their start in the police and also in organized crime. And Infernal Affairs 3 is a little bit of both, actually. It takes place after the events of this movie and before. And it forms like kind of like a Godfather-y kind of trilogy, is my understanding. I haven't seen them. I know some people are really big fans, and some people think they're completely extraneous. But this one, this holds up real good.
Yeah,
this is a cool watch, and you should definitely see this movie if you've seen The Departed or if you haven't seen The Departed. I think this is a good one. It's actually a really interesting double feature, I think, with Justice League, not because it's like the same movie or anything, but because
you're comparing two versions of the same story.
Here's one that's the same story, but a lot longer, and what you can get out of that. But here's one where the shorter version is also great and a very valid take on the material. It just plays very differently and seems to have a different point.
Yeah. It's pulp. It's good pulp.
It's great.
Quite good pulp.
Yeah.
Scorsese can do pulp. Watch something like Shutter Island.
Oh, that's total pulp.
Yeah, that's just a pulp thriller through and through. But yeah. I think he was a lot more interested in exploring bigger things, so he expanded into something quite different.
I feel like his is more about duality than anything else.
Yeah. I think The Departed is the better film.
Okay.
Frankly.
That's fair.
But I'm not going to say anything negative about Infernal Affairs. I think it's quite good. I liked it a lot. I'm glad I saw it. I felt like it was missing out on this kind of dorm room bro kind of movie with Infernal Affairs, and I'm glad I finally caught up on it.
No, this is a movie I had to track down from import stores when it initially came out because it wasn't making the rounds. And then it finally did come out on DVD in America, and it had a cover that had nothing to do with the film. And they're trying to show all the sexiness in the movie, and I'm like, it's not a sexy movie.
Yeah, no, there's no sex in the movie at all.
It's really, well, this one off camera maybe, but it's very, very, very serious and severe. This movie took a long time to kind of get treated right, I think, by America. But it's available now. It's on Paramount Plus.
Yeah, now it's just on Paramount Plus.
And if you have Paramount Plus, there's not a lot else to see. So see this.
But there's the movies. Some movies.
Fine. I'm not keeping it.
No.
I'm not keeping Paramount Plus.
Paramount has so many many movies in their vault, they could just put them all in.
I signed up for the free trial of Paramount Plus, and I watched
just to watch the movie.
I wanted to check out some of the stuff that they had and wanted to experiment with it, see if it was worth my while. No. And maybe when we get to our Star Trek podcast, All Our Yesterdays, when we get to Discovery and
Picard,
stuff, then I'll sign up. But we have a few years before I'll get there. Anyway, that is the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club. Next week, we'll be back with reviews of new films. And also, there's a poll up right now on the Critically Acclaimed Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. It's by the time this goes live, it should still be available for voting, but not for much longer. All our options are 1930s movies on the Criterion Channel.
It's all good movies.
Well, theoretically, we haven't seen them all.
That's true.
But we got some really cool picks on there. We got some films from Ozu and Dreyer and Renoir and Chaplin. So that's a cool lineup right there. So by all means, vote with your heart, vote with your head. Doesn't matter, just vote. We'd love to hear you. We'd love to hear your voice heard on our show. It's 12:50 in the morning, and I'm tired.
Well, let's wrap this up.
Let's wrap this up. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We're incredibly grateful to you, especially big thank you to our patrons. If you want to join us, it's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We have a lot of exclusive shows that are available for you. Shows about Batman, Star Trek. We got commentary tracks, stuff about Disney, the Oscars. Ton of stuff, all available exclusively for our patrons. patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. If you want to send us a message, you can either follow us on Twitter at William Bibbiani, at Whitney Seibold, at Critic Acclaim, or you can write us an email. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email on an upcoming episode of our podcast, We've Got Mail. So be sure to send in your questions, suggestions, got a criticism of something that we brought up in this episode or anything else. We would love to hear from you. If you like soap, of course you do, head on over to our Etsy store, etsy.com. Search for Salt Cat Soap. Salt Cat Soap is all one word. We have soaps designed by my wife and partner, M. Lopez de Silva, and I have my first soap design going live in the next couple of weeks. So I'm very excited about that. I think you're going to like it. Thank you, everybody, who's tried it out already and left us some really, really cool reviews. It's very nice of you. Thank you for your support. Whitney's cool.
Well, thank you. It's kind of you to say.
I love Whitney a lot.
You don't have to lie on the mic.
I don't have to. That's why I'm not doing it. Anyway, everyone's a critic and stuff.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?